Matter of Susan Ciago versus the Board of Trustees, Teachers Pension and Annuity Fund. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, this is Kathleen Napersek-Sarasano of the firm of Zazali, Fajella, Nowak, Kleinbaum, and Friedman, currently being called the Zazali firm.
Morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Sarasani, please.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Ratner, Associate Justice Luke. I appear before you this morning with the important goal of rectifying a serious disservice to a long-serving and loyal public school employee, Susan Ciago, whose retirement benefits will be significantly decreased because of the admitted and undisputed negligence and carelessness of her employer. Her request to process an unfortunately untimely interfund transfer of 13 years of pension credit from her Tier 1 PERS account to her current Tier 5 TPAP account was denied by an extremely strict and inflexible construction of the interfund transfer regulation by the Board of Trustees, who refused to exercise its equitable authority to relax the filing deadline when presented with the very particular facts of this case. This runs contrary to prior court rulings that pension boards should not act antagonistically to the best interests of their members, particularly those members who follow the guidance of their employers. Very simply, Mrs. Ciago completed the members' portion of the application for interfund transfer as soon as she was hired by Edison Board of Education for a teaching position. She had been employed for 13 years by Edison as a paraprofessional and had continued her education and obtained her teaching certification. And she completed this form a few months before she began teaching. Edison was required to complete the role employer section and certification and forward that form to the Division of Pensions when it enrolled her into TPAP. Unfortunately, we subsequently learned, Edison learned, that it had failed to file timely the application. It made numerous requests to the division that the transfer, though untimely, be processed because it was Edison, not Ms. Ciago, who was negligent in filing the application with the division and completing the interfund transfer process. The TPAP board's denial of the interfund transfer was sanctioned by the appellate court, which was so fixated on a statement in the interfund transfer regulation that a member desiring to transfer service credit and contributions from one state administered retirement system to another must file an application for interfund transfer. They interpreted this to mean that it was the employee, the member's responsibility to file that application for interfund transfer, not the employer's. This is incorrect. It's procedurally wrong. It's contradicted by the express statement on the application form that it must be filed with the enrollment application for the new pension system. And enrollment applications into pension systems are not filed by members, by employees. They are filed by the employer. Probably an issue a technicality that came up with this is these are paper applications for interfund transfer, and employers now for clearly at least a decade or so have filed, enrolled people into the pension systems through electronic means. So they're not, it's not like both papers are going at the same time. Both the TPAP board and the appellate court failed to appreciate the significance of Ms. Ciago's employer's role, of any public employer's role, in processing the application for interfund transfer. Instead, they placed the sole responsibility for processing this on Ms. Ciago. They rejected any argument that this situation warrants the application of equitable relief. The TPAP board does have discretion, even though they wanted to deny that, to exercise equitable authority to relax deadlines, reopen cases, overlook technical errors made in good faith when the circumstances warrant. This isn't and shouldn't, as they argued, be limited to just those situations involving false information or lack of information from someone at the Division of Pensions. Employees have a right to work with their employers, to trust their employers, to believe that they're, consult with them about their various employment situations, including in, you know, their pension retirement benefits. There are statements in Division of Pensions materials that advise them to do so. Ms. Siegel reasonably consulted with and relied upon the information provided to her by Edison, with whom she had a long-standing employment relationship. There's no reason not to believe their reinsurances about the filing of her application for interfund transfer. Her request for an interfund transfer should and must be approved. This will allow her to receive the benefit of her Tier 1 membership status. She's currently, her PERS was in Tier 1. Her TPAP is a Tier 5 because by the time she became a teacher and was enrolled, she was obligated to, they would have enrolled her, and they did, in Tier 5. She's suffering a significant financial loss by having her retirement benefits calculated as a Tier 5 member versus a Tier 1.
Counsel, you're familiar with the arguments that have been voiced on the other side and the concern about harm to the pension fund itself. Can you identify for us specific and narrow grounds that would support the relief you're requesting without affecting the integrity of the fund?
This money, if it's all right, may I get some water?
Of course. Okay. We're looking for a legal principle.
Okay. Well, they've allowed, the courts have in these various cases, have allowed members to relax the rule under particular circumstances. In this case, Ms. Siegel did file her application. She filed her application with her employer. She gave it to her employer. She expected her employer to process that. There are various situations. In this particular one with an interfund transfer, the statute doesn't particularly say that an employer has to, it doesn't put any imposition, any penalty on the employer. That is the case with delinquent enrollments and intra-fund transfers where the employer takes too long to transfer something, to file it, to enroll somebody. There isn't one in this case. It is an optional, which is what the division
what is the legal principle that would provide you relief in a narrow way that would not loop in a multitude of situations that might be different from
your case? The legal principle is that the court has the authority, or and the division, the agency, to reopen administrative matters upon a showing of good cause, reasonable grounds, and reasonable diligence. The cases that we presented, you know, in our brief, in our appellate brief, you know, reflect that. And in this case,
are there factors you would suggest we look to guide that discretion?
What?
Are there factors? Are there standards?
There are factors. In this case, Ms. Siegel, she the good cause is she went to her employer. She filed this paper with her employer promptly. The employer, she received assurances several times from her employer. We understand she did not contact the Division of Pensions. She looked at a paper. She brought the papers to her employer, to someone at the BA, and the person over there in the payroll department, and she pursued that reasonable diligence there, going back to her employer, questioning about that. They reassured her that they had filed, that the paperwork had been filed.
So let me ask you, if you could, to just step back from the facts for a second. You're ably presenting that argument. Are there principles that can guide these sorts of decisions in this as well as other cases that you would articulate for us?
Yeah, the principles that are set forth in
Same principles you were just talking about?
What?
The same?
Yeah, the same principles.
Same principles
that are in, listen, the court recently, they had been savage, and that was a very different case, you know, factually, where it was someone who had lost their pension, you know, an individual who would have lost a wife, a widow, would have lost her husband's pension. In other cases that we have, there is...
Can I ask you a hypothetical?
Digmont.
Can I ask you a hypothetical that differs from your client's facts? And that is, would you argue that there should be relief if, for example, someone, an employee was told by a school district, oh, don't worry about that application, we'll take care of it, and had not actually filled out part of the application?
Yes, there's been substantial compliance here. She filled out that.
You're not hearing my question. I'm not asking what she did. I'm asking whether, so we can explore the dimensions of the rule you're looking for. I'm asking you whether you would include an application by someone who said, well, I talked to them and they said they take the it's something for them.
No, Your Honor.
Okay,
no,
so that's a no.
That's
so
a no.
What's the principal distinction that separates your case?
Distinction.
Let me finish the question. Don't answer a question you haven't heard the whole thing. You don't want to agree with me. You may not agree with me. Are you saying that the distinction is that if the application or the portion of the application for which the employee is responsible has been filled out and submitted to the employer, is that the test here or part of the test?
That is part of the test. The employee here, remember, she filled out her part. She understood. I know there's various situations people don't even know that they can do this interfund transfer. That's not what we're talking about. She understood about the interfund transfer. She understood the consequences of doing an interfund transfer so that she could move her 13 years over into her new account and that she could retain her tier one membership.
So what's the other part? What's the other part? What additionally do employers?
Hold on.
So sorry. What additional steps must an employee take in order to ensure, pursuant to what we understand as the test that you're articulating, to ensure that they have reasonably and diligently completed their portion of what needs to be done in order for this transfer to proceed?
The employee here, the employee needs to fill out the form. The employee needs to give it to the employer that needs to file that. It is not the employee's role to file that form. Usually pensions will not take forms that people are filing like that directly because it goes in connection with the application for the new account so the money can be transferred into the new account.
Are you saying that the employee can never file the form? So if I understand the facts of this case and that the hypothetical that I'm suggesting is not the facts of this case, but if you had a situation where the employer says, give us our portion of the form, we'll fill it out, come pick it up next Monday, and here's who you have to mail it to. And the employee never shows up the following Monday, never picks up the form, never mails it. Are you suggesting that even in that circumstance?
No, I mean, I'm assuming they could try to, if they took the form and they filed it with the Division of Pensions. I'm not aware, and obviously in this case, whether or not Division would say, oh, this needs to come from the employer. Maybe the employee could have done that. But in this case, when an employee submits their portion, gives it to the employer, the employer says, we're going to file this. We'll file this with your employment, you know, your enrollment application for TPATH. She filled this out in July, and then they processed it a month or two later. They enrolled her in TPATH. And then she did go back to them when she received notification that said her PERS account had not had any more contributions made into it since some time about 2 years prior.
So just to make sure I understand, you're suggesting that the exercise of reasonable diligence would depend on what the employer had indicated had to happen next. So if the employer says you have to come pick up the form and mail it, then of course it would not be the exercise of reasonable diligence to never pick up the form and mail it. But if the employer says, okay, thank you for completing your portion, we're now going to send it in, then that would be the only thing that the employee would be expected to do.
That's correct.
So, counsel, I have a question for you about the record and specifically about a comment that you made. You said that the employer reassured your client several times that the application had been filed. My first question is, did the employer reassure your client that the application had been filed within the 2-year period? Did they reassure her that within the 2-year period?
I am not exactly sure, Your Honor. I do know that she, when she got, well, yes, it would have been within that 2-year period because she received that letter in March of 2019, which falls within that 2-year period.
Let's talk about the letter. The letter was in March. It was 1 year and 8 months after her last PERS payment. And the letter says that the Division of Pension and Benefits notified your client that she did not contribute to her PERS account since June 30th, 2017. Did your client go to the employer at that time before the 2 years expired? Did she?
Yes, she did.
And did the employer assure her at that point that they filed the application?
Yes, they did.
Who from the employer assured her of that?
It was someone in the, I don't have the name of the person. It was someone in the payroll department who no longer worked in the payroll department subsequently when the document was found. Let me see if I can find the name of the person.
Is it someone in payroll or someone in HR?
I believe it would have been, it was the person back in human resources payroll. There's a document in our appellate brief, the appendix, page 20A, where they were supposed to do some payroll action. So the individual there in payroll, it appears to be this Kay DeBaker. There's someone that signed off on that. My client had told me that she spoke to the person in payroll. They had said they had taken care of it. It had been filed.
And the important point I want to make is, did your client go to the employer after she received the letter from the division in March, before the 2 years expired, to say, did you file the application? Did she do that?
Yes, she did.
And this person, Dee DeBaker, you're telling us, reassured her that the application had been filed. Am I correct?
Yes.
Is that in the record? There was no hearing.
No, there was no hearing.
Was this a disputed fact about whether she had been reassured, as you pointed out multiple times, several times you used, before the 2 years expired, that the employer had filed the application? Is that disputed?
Disputed. I believe that the pension board said that they, regardless of whether or not she had, you know, they would basically accept whatever facts we had said about what the client had done, that she had gone, the member had gone to her employer and spoken to her employer. The board of trustees had said that she needed to go to the Division of Pensions. It's the Division of Pensions that she should, or her employer should have.
You're asking us to employ principles of equity. And I'm trying to learn whether before the 2 years expired, someone from the Board of Education, an employer representative, assured your client that in fact the application had been filed. Are you telling us that that happened?
Yes, that's what my client has informed me.
And the only part of the record that would support that is P20A, is that it?
Well, I'm looking back at that. She did not get a letter. She said she went to speak to someone there.
Is there an affidavit from her that says this?
No, I don't.
Is there an affidavit from the person from the Board of Education that said that?
No, I don't. When we went before the TPAC
Board. Did you ask for a hearing before an ALJ to further establish that your client had been informed before the 2 years expired that the application not only would be filed, but was filed? Did you ask for a hearing?
Yes, we did ask for a hearing and the board denied it. The board said that the facts, they would take the facts as we had presented them, and that it did not matter, that the law did not allow them to give to provide this sort of flexibility to change anything because the document was not filed within the 2-year period of time, and that they had no record in their records at the Division of Pensions that either Ms. Sego or someone from the Board of Education had contacted them to confirm this.
So I take it, I just have two very simple questions. From what you're saying, I take it your argument is that under the very specific facts of this case, cabining the issue to the facts of this case, the board had the authority to grant equitable relief to your client.
Yes, that's what I was saying.
The board's position was, no, we don't.
Correct.
Okay.
So if we agreed with you that the board erred when it stated that it did not have the authority to relax the regulations, should we then remand the matter back to the board with instructions that they may, in fact, consider the equities at stake, including any fiscal impact on the fund, on Ms. Sego, practices used in other school districts, potential effects on other fund members? Do you agree that, or what do you, what's your answer to that? Should we remand for the board to consider the equities in the first instance?
Yes, twofold. First, I am asking the court to see under these circumstances as presented to just grant my client's request that she be allowed to interfund transfer, to process the interfund transfer at this time. If the court has reservations about that, then I certainly am requesting, as we requested before the board, the TPAC board, that we be permitted to have a hearing, to have some opportunity in which to present additional evidence, and that they must consider the employer's role in this. What they very specifically said, very firmly indicated, was it really doesn't matter what the employer's role was in this, that it was the employee's obligation to pursue this further.
I think I'm asking a different question. If we were to agree with you that the board erred in stating they did not have the authority to consider the equities, could we remand for the board to consider the equities in the first instance, or are you saying that the board would need to have a hearing first before it could consider the equities?
You could remand back to the board. I do know that oftentimes the board will say, well, we've just looked at these equities. You know, we could submit some additional documentation, some additional hearings. This particular TPAC board meeting at which this matter was considered happened to be very early in the COVID period of time in which we were just doing telephone conferences, made it a little more difficult sometimes for the questioning of the members, the testimony. Oftentimes when we go to a Board of Trustees meeting for one of the pension boards, the member will be there with me and we will present and they will testify about various factual.
Did the board weigh the equities in this case, or did they simply say they couldn't do it because the time had expired?
They might have made a very quick statement that they considered the equities. What they said was, in this case, the equities did not show that the Division of Pensions had done anything wrong. And absent the fact that the division had done nothing wrong, they hadn't contacted the division and received, you know, improper information or anything about this, that it was essentially, that was their review. And they denied it because it did not fall within the parameters of the time.
What competent evidence is there about the key point that you're making in support of your client's claim? And that is that she went to someone in payroll and was assured that everything had been done. And this is all within the 2-year time period. That seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, to be the key fact that you're basing your claim on.
Yeah, in this case, the initial appeal, the initial requests to have her pension credit were through the business administrator and their department.
No, I get that, but what I'm saying is that, right, that you're focusing on, and we were talking about differentiating this case from perhaps others that have different facts. You're focusing on her going to the payroll department at the Board of Ed, if I'm understanding correctly what happened, and and raising this issue and being assured it was already done. What competent evidence is there about that?
I have my statements from my client, from the member, and I know I had spoken to the business administrator there, who's now retired, but I could contact him. There we could find it.
What's in the record?
Right, I guess we'd have to locate. We did not bring the person or get a statement from that individual.
And you have a statement. What do you mean by statement?
Well, I'm saying we did not contact the try to reach out to the person who was no longer working there when this when the Interfund transfer form was discovered by the new person in that was working there in payroll, someone in charge of payroll, and she went to the BA. We did not reach out and try to contact. I spoke to my client. She told me that she had spoken to someone. She had spoken to an individual. We did not pursue that when we went before the board initially. I did not get an affidavit from her. I did not try to track down the person. We went to the pension board hoping that we could convince them that under these circumstances, they should, process the form. We wrote our appeals there and then it was denied.
You pointed to 20A in the appendix. Can you tell us what that document is?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was the one document that I had was paperwork that was sent to, it's stamped that it was sent to the Division of Pensions, but it was a human resources it says payroll action notice that was completed in July of 2017, basically explaining or processing some things for Ms. Siegel when she was going to be enrolled into TPAF. So this has the name of the person who worked in payroll.
So it doesn't document the conversation that you described?
No, it does not.
And okay. The employer here also submitted her enrollment in TPAF. Is that correct?
Yes.
So at the same time that your client submitted the paperwork to her employer for the interfund transfer, she also submitted the TPAF enrollment, and the employer in this instance did forward the TPAF enrollment because shortly thereafter in 2017, she received certification that she was enrolled in TPAF and those deductions began.
The interfund transfer form that she executed was in July of 2017, and that's a paper form. They utilize paper forms. The enrollment application is now done what they call through, it says EPIC enrollment application. I don't know how long, pensions would know that better than me, how long they've been doing that, but it's an electronic application. It's no longer a paper application. That was actually submitted in September of 2017.
By the employer?
By the employer, okay. Yes. The employer goes online. The certifying officer, I believe, to the best of my knowledge, all my years of working with members and working with Division of Pensions, every employer, public employer, has someone who's designated as a certifying officer, and they're the one that files things.
So by September of 2017, your client was informed that the employer had done what the employer indicated they would do, and enrolled her and forwarded her enrollment or submitted her enrollment through TPAF.
And she went into the TPAF account. That's correct.
Right. So if she had followed up, it probably wouldn't have been unreasonable to believe what was told to her, that everything had been taken care of, because she knew at least one portion of her enrollment process had been taken care of because she was already enrolled in TPAF.
She was enrolled in TPAF. She started to have deductions taken out for TPAF. That's why when she received that other letter in March that said, no contributions were made to your PERS account since June of 2017, and she talked to the employer, she told me that the employer said, well, no, because you're not making, you weren't making contributions into PERS anymore. You're making contributions into TPAF. And she asked, well, what, did the interfund transfer? They said, don't worry. This is what she has conveyed to me.
Counsel, if there's no evidence in the record that we can find that supports that conclusion, that she followed up or that there's a conversation that's confirmed somewhere by a statement or any certification, do you still feel that there's enough for substantial compliance before that point for your client to succeed on this court granting the transfer directly?
I believe so, but if the court feels that they need more information, then I am requesting that it be remanded back so that we can put together and present the rest of the information, the supporting evidence.
Can you tell us what factors you would rely on to say that you believe so, that there is substantial compliance short of that evidence?
Well, the employer itself, the board of the business administrator had submitted a number of of documentation explaining that when they submitted the interfund transfer form that they located in the file that had never been filed. They submitted, the business administrator submitted additional, correspondence and documentation stating that this is, that they were supposed to file this, that they had failed to file it, that the client had, been told by Human Resources Department that this is what she had to do, and they didn't have, she didn't have to do anything more.
That's part of the record? What? That those documents you're now referring to are
those documents were before the appellate court. Yes, they were.
Were they before the board?
Yes, they were before the board.
OK, so where are they in the appendix?
All right. In the appendix, they are at 30A. I think it's maybe multiple.
Perhaps also 19 and 24, where it says, please accept this as a letter of request for interfund transfer. Quote, this oversight was not the employee's fault. Is that what you're referring to, perhaps?
Which number? I'm sorry.
19 and 24.
19 and 24. Yeah, there's a subsequent letter.
You're referring 19, to the letter.
Let's see, 24.
Are you referring? I know you're referring to 30, and at the letter in which the Edison Township Board of Ed indicates that she claims she was told by our Human Resources Department that when she became a teacher, she didn't have to do anything to transfer time except fill out her portion. We do not doubt that she was told this because at the time that was all she needed to do.
Yes, that's the subsequent letter to
these items of evidence were submitted to the board after the 2 years had expired, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But they were evidence that something had happened within the 2 years.
Yes.
Counsel, we understand your position. You want a statement that the board has the authority to grant the relief here, and that either the court, through its review of the record, grant that relief or send it back for a hearing and a consideration of the equities here.
That's correct.
Other questions, anyone? Counsel, anything you'd like to add?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Palumbo.
Justices, may it please the court. Under the circumstances presented, the board reasonably denied CEO's request to transfer her expired PERS membership her TPAF account. The member has 2 years to file an intra-fund transfer application with the division if they want to exercise that voluntary option. CEGO's application to transfer her PERS membership was filed with the division over 3 years after she discontinued her PERS service. Under the plain meaning of the relevant statutes and regulations, CEGO's PERS membership had expired over a year before her application was filed, and her PERS membership was therefore ineligible to transfer to TPAF. Specifically, the express statutory limitation that membership in PERS ceases 2 years after eligible service has been discontinued, and the clear regulatory restriction that membership can only be transferred if it is not expired. CEGO's argument regarding her continued public employment is a red herring. An interfund transfer necessarily involves the continuation of public employment. And NJSA 43:15A-7 and -41 are PERS specific statutes. They refer to the PERS retirement system and to PERS eligible employment. Nevertheless, CEGO argues that the appellate division and the board were too stringent and inflexible in their application of the rule, and she seeks to evade the legislative limitation and the regulatory restriction arguing that an administrative hearing was necessary to determine whether good cause existed. But the board accepted the truth of Seago's allegations, so there were no facts in dispute to require a fact-finding hearing. Based on the undisputed facts, the board was not arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable in rejecting Seago's equitable arguments. While the board has inherent equitable authority, it was reasonable for the board to deny Seago's request to open her expired PERS membership and grant her untimely transfer request under the statute and the relevant case law. For example, the board can use its authority to reopen a retirement selection after it is due and payable on a showing of good cause, reasonable grounds, and reasonable diligence. Those cases, like Duvin, deal with addressing orders entered by the division, not abrogating a statutory limitation and regulatory limitation. And they typically center on unique circumstances affecting the member's choice at the time of the retirement selection. For example, in Steinman, the member lacked critical information to make an informed decision because she had a pending workers' comp case and the board failed to advise her of the consequences of it. And in Savage, the member lacked capacity to change his selection during the 30-day due and payable period. The other case that Seago relies upon is distinguishable. In Zygmunt, the statute at issue was ambiguous, so this court remanded it for the board to consider whether it should exercise its discretion to waive or relax the rule. Under the circumstances here, the board was not unreasonable in rejecting Seago's equitable arguments and denying her request to interfund transfer her expired PERS membership. This court should affirm the appellate division decision. That concludes my preliminary statement.
So, counsel, you said there are no disputed facts, and that was the reason that there was no need for a hearing here. Is there a dispute that after Ms. Seago got the March 5th, 2019 letter saying, we're not done here yet, that she went to her employer and the employer assured her that it would be filed?
The board accepted that as true, Your Honor.
So then tell us what's wrong with the position that is being advanced here. An employee completes all of the required paperwork that the employee herself can and gets a promise after going back to the employer that the balance will be submitted in a timely way. What is wrong with the position that the board has discretion under those circumstances to grant relief?
Well, it's ultimately the member's responsibility to file the form. It's a voluntary transaction.
So what else should a reasonable employee do under those circumstances?
Well, with that letter in hand that showed that she had still had a year and 8 months later, she still had an open PERS membership, and she still was eligible for a PERS deferred retirement benefit, neither of which would be true if her account had transferred, she should have at least reached out to the division, because the division has no idea that a member is trying to interfund transfer until they get an application, because it's a voluntary. It's not the same as an enrollment, which is mandatory, and that is the responsibility of the employer to file.
But she didn't sit and do nothing. She went to the crux of the problem, that Edison hadn't completed their role in all of this. Why was that not enough?
Edison was the cause of the problem. They had already assured her that they would take care of it. She gets this letter showing that they hadn't done it, and then still goes back to them for them to tell her the same mistake that they had made.
That would have letter, to know. Yeah. Sorry.
No. That letter didn't suggest that they hadn't done it yet, just that the account hadn't triggered yet.
Well, if they had done it, it would have transferred.
But even the letter doesn't say, just so you know, your account never transferred, correct?
Well, because the division doesn't know that she's trying to transfer. They only know that she still has an open PERS account and still is eligible for a PERS retirement benefit.
But there's a leap that you're asking her to make to understand how the system works, that the fact that there are no more contributions being made means that her transfer wasn't made to TPAF yet.
Well, if her PERS account had transferred, she wouldn't be eligible for a PERS retirement benefit, and that's clear in the letter.
So I want to follow up on your suggestion. Had she contacted the division directly and said, listen, I went to Edison, they haven't finished the paperwork, we're proceeding apace, would that have created a situation where she would be entitled to relief?
We certainly would go towards it. We don't know what would have happened if she had contacted the division.
Would the board have had the authority to grant relief under those circumstances?
Yes.
They could have.
So because they weren't given a courtesy heads up that Edison had not yet succeeded in what it was supposed to do, it doesn't have authority, but had they known about that and done nothing else, they would have had the authority?
They have the authority. It's just that they didn't feel it was warranted with the circumstances that were presented.
That's so helpful. So if I could, so they had the authority in this case. Are you conceding that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we understand that from the board's own decision, where it looks like at PA 36, the board stated that it, quote, has no authority to grant Ms. Seago's request in accordance with NJSA 43-15A7 and NJAC 17-3-7.1. How do we understand from that the board recognized that it had the authority, but it was just choosing not to exercise it under the circumstances because it did not believe that the equitable circumstances justified it?
So that letter was the initial decision of the board. Then Ms. Seago appealed that initial decision, and the board issued a final agency decision. And in that decision, it's clear that they considered the circumstances here because they addressed them all.
So where do they say we have authority to grant your request, but we're choosing not to do so in light of the circumstances or something like that? Where do they acknowledge that they do have the authority to relax the regulations?
They don't expressly say that, but there would be no point to go through each of Ms. Seago's allegations. If, for example, if they felt they had no authority whatsoever, there would be no reason to go through her the reasons that she gave for filing it untimely. They could have just said, "You didn't receive it within the 2 years. You're out of time. There's nothing we can do."
Is that what you told the appellate division?
No, we did argue equities in the appellate division.
And didn't the appellate division said that the board had no authority?
The appellate division didn't say that the board had no authority.
It didn't have the authority in this case.
In this case, based on the circumstances and the case law, that's...
But you already admitted they did have authority. They just decided the equities didn't sufficiently weigh in favor of the plaintiff.
Yes, this court has said that the board has inherent equitable power to relax deadlines.
You had referred to the deadlines from the statute and the regulation interchangeably. I want to be a little bit more specific. What specific parts of the statute are you referring to? Because I'm looking at NJSA 18A:66-15.1, where it says a member who is a member of the, and then it's PERS, at the time of enrollment in TPAP, and who within 3 years of the date of that enrollment ceases to be an active contributing member of PERS, may transfer all service credit in the PERS to TPAP upon completion, upon application and transfer of the member's contributions from PERS to TPAP. Where do we see in that, where it specifically is talking about 3 years, that there is a two-year time limit on any transfer from PERS to TPAP?
That statute... Prior to that statute, members weren't allowed to transfer their membership from one system to another. So this grants them the power to be able to do that. It gives them the option. It doesn't specify a timeline in there, but the timeline comes from the other statute where it's clear that membership ceases 2 years after you discontinue service with the PERS. Once your membership ceases, you no longer have the rights and privileges of a member to exercise these options.
How would you know that from the statute, not the regulations? Where in the statute does it say that no transfer can be completed after 2 years or after your membership has expired?
It doesn't say that. It's just in 43:15A-7 and 43:15A-41, it makes it clear that your membership ceases after 2 years. After your membership ceases, you don't have the rights and privileges of being a member anymore.
What about in the regulation where it makes it seem like you can continue to make a transfer as long as your membership was not vested? So I'm looking at NJAC 17:3-7.1B53, I think.
Correct. That's exactly what you're talking about, Your Honor.
Okay. So what does that mean? Where it says specifically, members may not complete such a transfer, and it's referring to from PERS to TPAP, if, quote, the account has expired, it has been more than 2 years from the date of the last contribution, and the member is not vested.
Three goes to a very particular circumstance. So the general rule in B is that once your membership expires, you can't transfer it. BIII is addressing a particular circumstance where you're still a member, but the account has expired. That could happen if, say, a teacher works for 2 years, a year or two, then they leave for 2 years, that account is now expired, and then they get rehired as a teacher, they are a member again. So they're a member of TPATH, but their account has expired, that prior account. They have a new account. In that situation, you can't interfund transfer because technically you're a member of TPATH. You have an active membership, but you can't interfund transfer that old expired TPATH account into your new current TPATH account.
I'm sorry, say that one more time. So where it says, and if the account has expired and the member is not vested, what is that referring to?
But before it gets to that, where it says the account, it says a member. So it's assuming you're already a member of TPATH, but your account is expired. Meaning?
What does it have to do with vesting? That's just my question. Why does it say, and the member is not vested, if it doesn't matter one way or the other, if the member is vested?
I'm not sure what, we never briefed why the vesting comes into play, but III is just irrelevant in this situation.
But you agree here that she was vested because you vest after 10 years, correct? Right. And she had more than 10 years in PERS. So she was vested.
Yes, her PERS deferred retirement was vested.
You've told us the division had the authority to grant relief here. And I want to ask you about the principles outlined by the appellate division in Sellers, where the court said that the board can apply equitable principles when justice demands, if it's done rarely and sparingly, and it will not harm the pension system. And then the active went on to identify a number of considerations. Did the government turn square corners? Did the employee act in good faith? What's the degree of harm that will be sustained here by the employee? What's the purpose of the restriction? Is that a sensible approach to try to resolve these sorts of issues?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So then tell us why it is that the board's decision is appropriate in light of these considerations. Did the employee here act in good faith?
She did act in good faith, but she didn't have good cause and reasonable diligence because it was ultimately her responsibility to file this form.
Did the government, looking at what happened with Edison, turn square corners here?
That Edison, the division and the board certainly turned square corners here. The division had no idea that Ms. Siegel was trying to do an interfund transfer. They didn't give her any misrepresentation whatsoever.
So is it or is it not appropriate to consider Edison's failure to act appropriately here when we consider whether the government turned square corners?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Degree of harm? Does the board dispute that Ms. Siegel has suffered harm here?
She certainly does, but she there's no forfeiture. She still is entitled to receive her PERS Tier 1 retirement
yes.
benefit, and she will receive a TPATH service retirement upon retirement from the TPATH.
Let me ask you the question that some of us asked your colleague on the other side. If you were not to prevail, what would narrow grounds be to overturn the ruling of the appellate division here and yet not create challenges to the integrity of the fund?
Question, Your Honor.
And I'm not asking you to forsake your argument. I understand your position is that we should affirm.
Yes, absolutely. It's difficult because without the division knowing that a member is trying to apply for this, in order to administer the fund, that account ceases. And now it's done, it's locked in. And if we allow employers to hold on to these forms and send them in a year after, 2 years after, 5 years after, it essentially keeps that account open indefinitely.
Counselor, are you aware of whether or not the board has made any efforts to check with other jurisdictions whether or not they have regulations in place that would cause the same exact problem?
You mean outside of New Jersey?
No, and outside of Edison.
Oh, no. Are you talking about the fact that Edison, it's their policy to complete this form?
Right. And that's an issue in terms of what was told to the employee through the regulations in that specific place. Has there been any effort to ferret out whether this is happening elsewhere in the state?
No, not that I'm aware of. I know that the board and the division do look into ways to try to ameliorate the situation, but I don't think they reach out to municipalities to see what. I do know that most employers will help out the employee to fill out the form and send it in, but ultimately it is the employee's responsibility. And going back to a question that was asked, but I can't remember which justice asked it, the employee certainly can go to the employer, have them fill out their section and send it into the division if they want.
But I'm sorry, you just conceded that most employers send in the form on behalf of the employee, correct?
That's correct. They do.
And have you made any changes? I'm looking at page 24 of the appendix, which I believe is the actual form. It says application for interfund transfer. And then it says this application must be completed by you and your former employer. And there's a part one and a part two. And the part two specifically says certification of former employing agency. Have any changes to that form been made so that it is clear that it is the employee and not the employer's responsibility to send it in?
I'm not aware of any changes to the form.
Can you explain some of the administrative problems? The chief asked you a question about the impact on the system. Can you explain some of the administrative problems if an account is opened or kept open or you don't know that it's closed? But as I understand it, after there were no contributions in this case made to the PERS account after a certain point in time, and contributions were being made to the TPEAF account after that point in time. So the funds were there in the pension, correct?
Correct, but they're funds in two separate.
I understand. There's an administrative problem you're suggesting because you don't know that this one's closed, even though it has been closed after 2 years, and you don't know this one's been open, even though the money's going into the fund.
You know that the TPAP is open.
Okay, and money's going in there.
Correct.
So would you please, the chief's question I think was, maybe this wasn't exactly it, I'll ask you. Other than the administrative problem of having a closed account that's still registered with you and an open account that's not, what is the danger or risk to the firm, to the pension?
It's not just the contributions and her service credit that transfer. It's also the liabilities that attach to that retirement benefit that
like,
suddenly transfer.
Like what?
The retirement benefit that she will get.
She's paying into it.
In her TPAP account, but it will switch. Right now it's a closed PERS account, set, it's dead, it's
okay, so
13 years, and suddenly it becomes a tier
so
one.
So she might be claiming, I guess, or could claim PERS benefits on that closed account while also having entitlement under TPAF, because she's been contributing to that account.
I thought you said that's what would happen if it didn't transfer, though. I thought you said, you know, don't worry, she can still get the PERS benefit. There's no actual forfeiture. I heard you say there's no forfeiture of the PERS.
That's correct. Right now,
that's not what I'm asking. Okay? So your concern is that she would have entitlement to the PERS while she was still contributing to TPAF. Correct?
No, the concern is that TPAF will not have to pay this liability on her retirement benefit, whereas before it was...
Liability on which retirement benefit?
If the PERS retirement, if her PERS membership is transferred to TPAF...
I'm not saying it's transferred.
Oh, if it's not transferred, then PERS will pay her PERS retirement and TPAF will pay her TPAF retirement.
Okay, so we have her making... She's made all the contributions she's got to make. It's not like the pension... Whether she gets PERS or TPAF, depending on what the decision is, the money has been contributed by the employee.
Correct.
So the financial stability of the fund is not the problem.
That's if you look at the fund as all the funds together, but these funds are separate.
Understood. The fund, the TPAF, those funds are not at risk because she has been contributing. The problem is, how do you get the PERS money that's already there into TPAF, right?
But along with the PERS contributions comes the liability of
her. Are you saying that the liability of the fund is higher because she would be tier one if her position was accepted?
what I'm trying to say is probably inarticulately is right now she has a PERS account. I don't know how much it's worth, but say in retirement, it's a $500,000 liability. If it switches to TPAF, now that's a $500,000 liability in TPAF. Sure, PERS benefits, but now TPAF doesn't. TPAF has to account for that $500,000
liability. But that doesn't, does that matter? Whether if today we said, take all our PERS money and put it in TPAF to which he's been contributing. PERS is now cut off. No more contributions. Put it in TPAF to which he's been contributing. Is that any different than if the interfund transfer had happened within those 2 years? Is the financial burden or risk to the pension any different?
No, but if it had happened within the 2 year period, when the actuaries are projecting these accounts, they see that there's an account that incurs that is.
I understand, but the financial risk to the pension, the financial obligation of the pension is exactly the same.
That's correct. If the interfund transfer.
Because I'm just trying to get, well, whether it did or it didn't, if it happens today and she's been contributing, maybe I'm, if it happened today and she's contributing to TPAP and has been for all this time, and all that PERS money is still there, if that transfer happened today, the pension fund or funds are at no greater risk than if it had happened 2 years ago or 2 years before or 2 years before that.
The risk would just be the instability of being able to make accurate projections to each separate fund going forward.
Because there may be 50 other cases out there that will surface tomorrow. That's what you're, that's
yes,
your
sir.
Point.
If there's a, maybe not one, but if there's multiple that all switch from PERS to TPAF and all that liability switches from one fund to another fund, all of a sudden the TPAF fund is the financial models and actuary data is meaningless almost.
But you're but that would be the case if it transferred within the 2 years also, right? So if 50 people in 1 year got a new job where they had been a paraprofessional and then they become a teacher and they all switch from PERS to TPAP, all of a sudden now TPAP is going to owe a ton more money that they didn't know before, correct?
That's correct. But I think that they are able to project that knowing that the accounts are still open. So there's still that possibility. But once they are closed, it's a closed, locked-in account. And one data point of certainty when they're making these projections and having the actuaries account for the funds.
But you can't project for when people decide to leave the position. So that happens over the course of the year and creates a certain level of instability over the course of an entire year anyway.
Yes, this would just create more uncertainty.
But do you concede the fact that SIGO did lose in terms of the financial conclusion for her retirement purposes?
The option to interfund transfer would have been beneficial to her.
This is but one factor, though, because if it were determinative, the inability to project properly based on what happened here, then no relief would ever be granted. The board would never exercise its discretion in favor of someone like Ms. Siegel, right?
That's correct, but that is why it needs to use its equitable power rarely and sparingly.
And that, I'm sorry,
you go ahead, please.
We'll go down the line. Or go down the line. And that, are talking about the extent to which this would destabilize the fund, the pension fund. Are you aware of any other circumstance other than this case in which someone, an employee, has filled out their portion of the form and the employer has failed to process it? Or is this case an outlier?
No, that typically is how these occur, where the employer...
But the employer fails to forward the application. Are the circumstances here replicated in any other case that you are aware of?
Where the employer forgot to fill out their portion, or where the employer...
No, the employer didn't, whether they forgot or whatever reason.
There was another case recently where the employer refused to fill out their employer section. And the allegation there was that the It was a separate employer. They left on acrimonious terms, and the employer, the allegation that the board considered and accepted was that the former employer was retaliating and specifically refused to fill out their section of the form.
And the board granted the relief in that case?
When it was denied, but in the appellate division, the court sat in equity and decided that it was unreasonable for the board in that situation.
I think the question is, are there a lot of cases like this?
I looked into that, Your Honor. There's about 2.5 per year, between 2 and 3. There's been...
out of a universe of...
Excuse me?
Out of how large a universe?
Just per TPAF.
Of cases where the employer either did not want to fill out the form or forgot to fill out the form, and it was through no fault of the employee that their application for the interfund transfer did not get submitted.
I don't have the exact details of all of them, but where the employee is appealing and saying, my employer either forgot or didn't send in this form.
Okay. And how many
has the division made any changes to the TPAF member guidebook, which states that the employer should submit the application for the interfund transfer?
I'm not aware.
So the current guidebook from the division still states that for these interfund transfers, the application should be submitted by the employer to the division?
I'm not 100% sure.
And in those other two cases where the employer did not file, did TPAF relax the rules?
Do you have a citation, sorry, to the case where you said the appellate division reversed?
That was, the name of the case is Grabstein.
G-R-A-T-F-T-E-I-N.
And that's an unpublished appellate division decision?
Yes, Your Honor, it's unpublished.
If the guidebook still contains the information that Justice Pierre-Louis read for you, does that factor into turning square corners?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the guidebook specifically says that if there's anything that conflicts with the statutes or regulations, the statutes and the regulations will control.
And we spent a good portion of time today trying to get some clarity on what the statute and regulations mean. And I think anyone who's been in government would agree that sometimes these benefits, it's not very clear what the process is, what applies, and what the benefits are. So in a lot of instances, the member guidebook guides the employee, because it's not many employees. We're sitting here trying to understand what the statutes and regulations state. I don't know if many employees are going to be able to figure that out on their own by looking at the statute and regulations, but the division itself publishes a guidebook to assist employees in that endeavor. And you have a guidebook specifically stating that the employer should be submitting this application. How can that not factor in to our decision when we're trying to determine what is appropriate here and what's equitable?
The only thing I can say is that under the regulation and the statutes, the regulation puts it on the member to file.
And yet the employer, I think you said before, I don't remember the term used, almost always is the one who files their section.
They often help because
is it often or is it almost always?
I'm not sure, but it's probably more often than not, because the employer has to submit that. The employer is required to fill out and submit the enrollment application. So oftentimes they just submit the enrollment application with the interfund transfer.
And they submitted the enrollment application here, but not the interfund transfer.
Correct. And that's why the March letter, and then we haven't discussed it at all, but there's also the September 2019 letter that Ms. Segoe received saying that her account now is expired and still didn't contact the division for over a year before her application was filed.
That's because her employer told her that they had filed the application.
But again, if they had filed the application, her PERS membership wouldn't have been open in March and her account would have expired in September. she had these two letters. Even after the letter that she received saying your account's expired, nothing was filed with the division for over a year.
Mr. Palumbo, can you clarify one more thing? You said there are 2.5 or so cases a year like this. Out of a universe of how many? How many interfund transfer requests are done each year appropriately?
Sorry, I don't have that number.
Is it hundreds? Is it thousands?
I don't even know if I can estimate, but it would be more, I would think, in the hundreds than the thousands.
Thank you.
Again, I'd just be guessing. I don't counsel the TPAC board, so I'm not at those meetings.
Okay. Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Nothing else, just that the division.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.